All right. Well, it's my delight and honor to get to speak with Dr. Richard Boothby today. Richard is professor of philosophy at Loyola University, Maryland. He's the author of a handful of books on Freud, Lacan, and philosophy. And I've been obsessively reading his latest two books, Embracing the Void, Rethinking the Origin of the Sacred, and Blown Away, Refinding Life After My Son's Suicide. And as we were just talking about a little bit, Richard, today I hope that we'll be able to lay out the way that you theorize anxiety, how it relates to Lacan's notion of Das Ding, the enigmatic desire of the other, how this anxiety differs from those parts or those put forth by Heidegger and Sartre. I'm interested in how you show how Lacan reframes an understanding of Freud's Oedipus complex, and then how all of these conceptual, I suppose, tools might ultimately help us to rethink the origin of the sacred. But before we get to that, I'd like to first talk about your memoir, Blown Away. As I said before we started recording, I got to the end of what I could read of this on the Google preview. And even though I had already ordered the physical copy of it, I couldn't wait those extra couple days to get it in the mail. So I had to just buy the Kindle version. And so I read the whole thing in about a day and the following morning. And so it's really touching, heartbreaking, insightful. So many of the chapters end on these cliffhangers that keep you reading. Just this incredibly honest window into what must be one of the hardest things that a parent could go through. And I guess my first question on this is what would you say now about this book?
Well, one thing, the main thing obviously is that this was my only child from my first marriage, which was 22 years in length. And my that boy, Oliver, died now 18 years ago. So it's been quite a long time. And that book only came out 2 years ago. And in the 15 or so years between his death and the publication, I had been working kind of like crazy with this, literally crazy sometimes, with this manuscript to try really to just tell myself what had happened. He had developed a growing addiction to various drugs, beginning way before my wife and I understood really what was going on. He was, whatever else he was a very smart kid. And yeah, plenty clever enough to conceal a lot of drug abuse from us. We only woke up to it when he was a sophomore and then really intensively a junior in high school, when he really had already become involved with some very over the top drugs, which were very, very accessible in Baltimore, Maryland, where we lived. And we tried to get him into, well, we did get him into a drug treatment center, but he kind of, I tell the story in the memoir about how he kind of weaseled out of it. It was amazing because he also became transformed in the case of in the length of, I don't know, 4 months or so. It was amazing because suddenly the son I loved so dearly was sort of back. But he also, when we visited, which was down in Baja California, in 2005, I guess, he or 20, no, a little bit earlier than that, 2003 or two even. Anyway, he was down there doing, as I say, great. He was transformed. He was back, you know. He was my beloved son again. But he announced when we visited that he had been molested by the director of this teen care camp operation, which totally floored us. It seemed completely out of keeping. Anyway, I won't go on too long about this, but the book tries to bring the reader back to what it was like for myself and my wife to go through this loss, preceded by this enormous struggle to save him. We said, we simply couldn't. And it the book I wrote it originally just for myself, really a survival program. I just had to tell myself and sort of rummage around anything I could make sense of what had happened. And partly as a result, well, largely exactly as a result of his death, I went into a 4 times a week work with a psychoanalyst here in Baltimore for more than 3 years. And I tell a lot of, I'd been an analyst before, but not really as a real suffering analyst. I'd done it more for the purpose of trying to understand something about psychoanalysis. Now I was trying to understand my own life. And the book alternates between entries about the week following his death. So it's really kind of like a diary almost of days that are very telling about what both about what happened, about who he was and what our relationship was like, and so on. But it's sort of oscillates between those and these sessions with this analyst, where I'm talking really a lot about my own life, my own history, and my own struggle to understand what had befallen him and.
Yeah, one of the things that I wrote down here about this book is that what I appreciate about it is so I've been doing analysis just over Zoom with an analyst now for about 5 months. And because I've had such an interest in psychoanalysis for a while, I'm talking with friends about it and I'm sharing what it's like to go into to be in session. And it's a analysis is a weird thing to explain, but what I appreciate about your book is that it just shows it through what you've written. It shows what that experience is like and how, through free associating, the analysand comes to uncover things that I don't know that you could get to in any other way. And in this, and so there were so many times where the chapters end and you've suddenly kind of talked yourself into a corner, but then something just somehow you kind of talk your way into uncovering something that you didn't even yet know about yourself, but that had been, maybe been with you all the time.
Yeah, those chapters about the analysis, of course, they aren't and couldn't have been real transcriptions of what happened, but I had to. That was one of the toughest things about writing the memoir, is that I had to do a certain amount of artful recreation of what feels like sessions. You know, it was a lot messier than that, but it did amaze me. Of course, you know, something like a the death of a child not only makes you so devastated that you feel like you need to lean on somebody else. You need to hear you know, use somebody else's ear to understand what the hell happened to you, you know. But also you really desperately need it, and you're really open. You're sort of desperately open, you know, torn open. So it was I think the course of the analysis and what came to me to understand about myself and my own history and life was both more much richer, but also much more wrenching than it would have otherwise been. It was kind of like an analysis on steroids or something. But at any rate, I hope it certainly felt to me at the end when I finished the text, the last versions of it, I thought, yeah, it's somewhat artificial the way I put them together, the sessions, but it felt right for the experience. And I have a feeling it's probably my sense is it's probably a pretty decent sampling of what a certain kind of analysis, especially one that's no nonsense. It's like almost a kind of a life or death exploration. It's probably fairly representative of a really intense analytic encounter.
Yeah, so for anybody listening or watching that's interested in psychoanalysis and kind of curious, okay, so what does it look like, kind of behind the curtain of what these sessions are? I feel like your book is somewhere that I'd maybe point somebody to, because as I've tried to explain it to some friends, they're like, what do you mean? They just listen? The analyst just is there and they just listen? And what do you mean they don't give you advice and this kind of stuff? So, and so this book, in the email that you sent me after I reached out, you said, well, you might want to also check out this memoir, Blown Away, as a that it in some ways lays a bit of a theoretical foundation for embracing the void. Because you talk about how in Blown Away that you eventually come to this place of, I guess, somewhat being at peace with what you can't know about things. And so I think that that'll start to make sense as being a foundation as we look into what embracing the void is.
That's an excellent point, though, to start with, because it's so true. My son's suicide, which was not totally unforeseeable. I mean, I was in dread that was where we were going to end up for months, if not a couple of years before his death. And he had made a number of attempts. But it was nevertheless, when it happened, there's something so indigestible about suicide. And virtually every loved one of someone who commits suicide basically says the same thing. There's some way in which you cannot process it, even though you may have seen it coming with perfect clarity. It's quite astonishing that way, how their willing death. Of course, the obvious thing is they die and you are haunted terribly by the unanswerable question about their last minutes. What were they thinking? What was really motivating them? Did they really even fully intend it? Blah, blah, blah. And of course, none of those questions are answerable, but it's m much worse than that. It kind of unzips retroactively your whole relationship, and you kind of think, good God, did I thought I knew him so deeply, and our relationship was so old and so, just dependable. If I knew anything, I knew this boy. And then suddenly you're in a kind of an abyss that you have never really experienced before. And that did have a huge part to play in my own intellectual, what shall I call it, my own intellectual adventure of the last 20 years. I went into philosophy precisely because I so valued trying to pose the big questions and make some progress and trying to kind of make sense of some of the big issues that face us existentially and so on. And the last 20 years, very much because of Oliver's death, but not only that, I really have become intellectually and also almost viscerally, I've become much more aware of how much we don't and cannot know. And I'm now, actually, I feel almost a kind of a bit of a apostate in my tribe of philosophers, because I now feel like the primary problem that really haunts me intellectually is this problem of the unknown that we live. Although usually we have convinced ourselves that no such zone of completely impenetrable darkness exists. We kind of figure we know what the game is, and sometimes it's actually annoying because we know it so well and it keeps happening so predictably. When actually, and a number of great philosophers, of course, have been onto this, but it's still shocking when it really happens to you personally, when the rug goes out from under you, and you sort of have this sense of, my God, everything essential to life is almost completely opaque. That's a mystery. Myself and my history and my love for people I loved. So yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with that. And the religion book that you were talking about and introducing a bit is driven by this turn toward the unknown.
Yeah. I'm gonna make a little audible here, and I think I will bring in this little song that my friend in the last episode that I recorded last week with my friend Matt. He came out with this album that is about struggling with doubt and faith and belief, and his journey over the last 10 years with all of that. There's a song in it called My Garden, and we talked about it in the last episode. And it was highly influenced by Peter Rollins and his work. And so Matt and I talked about it a little bit, but I realized that we didn't really hit on a key point in it that I think would be apropos to talk about here. So these are the lyrics of My Garden. He says, this is my garden. This is my home. I seem to have all I want, but in this garden, you give me all, but for one. And that's my only thought. I've seen this fruit. It will satisfy, delights my eye, and makes me wise, desired by all and had by none. This is my garden. Am I the only one? Because I am naked to my appetite. I cover up with no end in sight. I am naked. It's all your fault. You told me no. Now that's all I want. It makes me sick to feel this lack. Because if you're really love, I'd be rich with that. But in your garden, those gates are closed. The death of me is now I know. So I am naked to my appetite. I cover up with no end in sight. You told me no. Now that's all I want. That's all I want. Afterwards, I texted Matt back because we didn't. I texted Matt after the last episode, and I had brought up a few things in it, but I was like, the fruit that will satisfy, it's certainty, right? And he didn't text back. I said, right? And he said, sure. I might be wrong in that, but this fruit of certainty that delights my eye, makes me wise, desired by all and had by none. At least that's how I kind of, that's in my head thinking about, if I could just get back to, if I could just know what was going on in this person's head when things fell apart. So anyways, I guess I just wanted to throw that in there real quick, but
it's interesting though that you interpret that piece, and I'd be interesting to read it a few times more, because it's evocative in ways that make you think you got it, and then the next line or two later you lose your grip on what you thought you had. But It's interesting. I was tempted to interpret the lyrics as being as much about not knowing as about any kind of knowing. So I'm not sure what he was intending, what Matt was intending, but I went away thinking that the garden was as much a kind of dark spot that didn't allow for explanation as it was a familiar, reassuring place that made sense.
Yeah, I keep coming back to that song in particular quite a bit, and so yeah, I'll send you a link to or the name of the album in an email afterwards. But okay, so yeah, let's move on to Embracing the Void. So the book and some of the talks and the interviews that you've given about it and its main argument really address something that I'm wrestling with and am confronted with more and more. Lately, I'm finding myself in awkward situations in which it feels as though I'm expected or downright asked to give an unhesitating declaration of where I stand on this or that political or religious question. And I had been writing about this, and I wrote in this short little essay, the first line is, like, that I'm finding more and more in Christian circles, this obsessive need for the confession of belief, or, yeah, the declaration of one's political stance on various issues, as a sort of litmus test for who's in, who's out, who's saved and safe, and who's walking in darkness and in league with the devil. So it's kind of from those sorts of situations and writing about those and feeling something's not quite right here, that then I was listening to some different videos that Todd McGowan has on his YouTube channel, and I listened to your talk on Dodds Ding and The Sopranos, and I was like, wow, that this really is speaking to what I think I'm struggling with here. So I suppose maybe there's several routes that we could go down. I love the way that you tell like the Lacanian story of human development. I feel like that's a somewhat important, I don't know if you would call it like a myth. I think that Mari Rudy has called it a myth. How Lacan reframes the Oedipus complex. Yeah, Lacan's different, his understanding of anxiety and how that differs from Freud and Heidegger and Sartre. But then also, you know, in that talk on The Sopranos, you also started by talking about this Hobbesian presupposition that wolf is a man, or that man is a wolf to man. And so I was like, maybe there's some other way to kind of get started in talking about this book, but those are some of the different things that different routes that I thought maybe we could get started with.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I know.
Let me start with where I feel like I most started, where I got kind of drawn into something that I found really irresistible. I didn't realize it, by the way, until after I had finished Embracing the Void. I went back through previous things that I've written, that earlier three books and a bunch of essays and stuff. And I didn't realize how much the concept of the unknown thing, Das Ding in German, had been preoccupying me for decades, actually. I got so into it, and it's so much the core of Embracing the Void. It is the void of the title. I thought that it was maybe I was just kind of getting onto it, and I went back and looked at things I've written for decades, and I thought, wow, I've always been kind of obsessed with this. But it comes from the term. Das Ding is Freud's term. He uses it in the unpublished project for a scientific psychology of 1895. It not only unpublished, but he wanted his friend Wilhelm Fliess to destroy the copy that he had sent to him. Freud destroyed his own copy.
Yeah.
And Fliess didn't, as you is a famous sort of saving from the flames, this early text. And it's only a page or two where Freud says he speculates that the infant at some point has a dual apprehension of the mother. On the one hand, the infant sees a kind of mirroring, very similar, almost identical to the way Lacan thinks of the mirror stage, the formation of the imaginary ego as a kind of mapping of the image of the other onto my own body. And he says, okay, this happens, this kind of mirroring, this reflection in the other of what I am, and that's reassuring and orienting. Then he says, but there's something else, another dimension, in which the infant looks at the mother figure and doesn't understand at all what it's looking at, that the mother appears completely enigmatic, completely as a kind of closed box whose contents are unknown. And this, he says, he says it is as if that the infant is in relationship to something that is a mere thing, otherwise unknown, unknowable. And this thing, says Freud, is really the deeper core, which becomes a very telling kind of dimension for the rest of one's life about relations with others. And Lacan, Freud then drops it pretty much. We don't hear about it. He never publishes anything about this later. And were it not for that one surviving unwritten piece, we wouldn't know about it at all. But Lacan picks it up in his seventh seminar, the first half of the seminar, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis. He, all of a sudden, kind of out of nowhere, he brings it really front and center. And it's hard to overstate how Lacan privileges this notion and says, this is really the key. He says it's the kind of center of gravity of the entire system of unconscious Vorstellungen, the unconscious representations that make up my depths. All of that is kind of in the gravitational field of this unanswerable question of the other. And this is what then becomes really important to Lacan. When Lacan makes as his kind of fundamental, so often repeated, it's perhaps his most repeated phrase, human desire is the desire of the other. Well, in the ethics seminar, he really puts his chips on this square. He says, well, that otherness is the otherness of something that I cannot fathom in the other, a kind of opacity, something I fundamentally do not and cannot know in my apprehension of the fellow human being. That the fellow human being is inhabited by this kind of darkness, this zone of nothing I can understand, this thing. Lacan here is putting it really forward with enormous force as kind of the key to his whole take on the unconscious. What then makes it very weird is that he goes on for a long time unfolding the consequences of this vision of a rehabilitation, incarnation of Freud's ding, the unknown thing in the other. And then it disappears from the second half of that seminar. And it doesn't, however, totally disappear from Lacan's work there. It comes back in 6, 8, or 10 brief mentions in subsequent seminars. One of the most important, however, is in the seminar 10 on anxiety, where he says, I want to break from Freud. He says, Freud thought anxiety is fear without an object. Fear without an object, that would be anxiety. Well, that's Freud's fundamental definition of it. Lacan says, no, anxiety is not without an object. In fact, it relates to the most profound object, Das Ding, the object that is unknowable, the aspect of the fellow human being that I cannot grasp and can never understand. That's the source of anxiety, he says. Weirdly, again, it's weird. He's very strange. He's very kind of, I don't know how to even call it, whether he's being evasive or he himself seems caught up in massive ambivalence about his own kind of theoretical breakthrough here. But he definitely distances himself from it. I, on the other hand, having returned to this seminar, you know, many times through, I got again about 6 or 7 years ago really smitten with this idea and taking it really seriously, as if to ask, if we really take Lacan at his word about this breakthrough for him that seems so important, at least for some period, what do you get? And that's kind of the birth, the intellectual birth and framing of that book.
I was, listening to some talks with you, and I was in my backyard, had a glass of wine in one hand, and thinking on anxiety and this Lacanian idea of it being rooted in the mother, the primordial relationship. And I'm standing there, and this moth starts flittering towards me, and I kind of have this rush of anxious energy course through my body. And it brought to mind this, I instantly thought of this comedian doing an impression of Christopher Walken from that I heard a long time ago. And it was just, he says, I'll try my best Christopher Walken impression of Kevin Pollak doing an impression of Christopher Walken. He says, Frankenstein never scared me. Marsupials do, because they're fast and they dark. That's crazy. So that the moth, fluttering towards me, I'm thinking on anxiety, that memory pops into my mind, followed also by the memory of being stung by a bee on the bottom of my foot when I was like 5, and how I have always been pathologically anxious around bees, and something about this unpredictable movement of the moth, the marsupial, the bee, and then going, oh, so would I, maybe there's some way in which this is linked to, you in the talk that I was listening to, you were talking about kind of this unpredictable, not quite being able to, as the infant, being able to understand or predict what it is that the mother wants from me or you as the infant. It's at some points she's seems so lovingly present, and then at other times kind of absent or like concerned with other things. Sometimes I think you talked about how sometimes kind of the grossed out by the diaper or something. Does that spark anything from there?
Well, of course, the problem of the mother is, was for Freud too, the real heart of the matter for his framing of the Oedipus complex. And it's interesting the way Freud ends up framing it. The thing, the unknowable thing, particularly if we go with Lacan's interpretation, this thing, which is the source of anxiety at the most fundamental level, that doesn't seem to be, once Freud has dropped the thing and let the unpublished manuscript disappear, disappear from the world, disappear from his own mind too. He seems to say the Oedipus is the mother as the kind of emotional homeland, the sort of comforting and blissful, deeply desirable relation. which then is interrupted and forced into a kind of severance by the father. This is the being torn away from the one object that seems to be unequivocally desirable for the child. This is Freud's whole scheme of the problematic and ambivalent launching of the human subject. But Lacan really, even if he takes some distance from Das Ding, talking about it as he does in the first half of the seventh seminar, even with that, the traces remain in him. He's very different in his understanding of what happens in the Oedipus. If we're even going to keep calling it the Oedipus, in his later works, he almost recommends dropping the word altogether. But he's already really doing something different. The mother for Lacan, at one point, he compares the mother to an all kind of devouring praying mantis, or he presents the mother at another point as a kind of voracious crocodile that's going to basically, you know, eat you. These are not small asides; they're very essential. That Lacan feels that there's something in the mother that is not just problematic, it's terrifying. It's something that the infant has to take refuge from. And this is when then you begin to get this idea that weaning, I make a fairly big deal of this in the book. That's not a long passage, but it's an interesting intersection between Simone de Beauvoir in The Second Sex, when she talks a bit about Freud's Oedipus, and she sort of says, I want to do a kind of some major surgery to the whole idea. She is doing something similar. She's saying that the mother actually prompts, in a sense, the infant to make its own weaning, its own separation, its own self-protecting withdrawal from the mother, as if you're getting away from something threatening. And this theme comes back in Lacan a good deal, not least in the famous paternal metaphor of his kind of classic period, where he says, the desire of the mother has to give way to the law of the father, the nom du père, the nom, as in N-O-N, the no, the father, the classic Freudian father who says, no, no more mother, I'm cutting you off.
Right.
But also the nom is as in N-O-M, the name of the father. So what does it mean? It's a huge part of Lacan's theory. We can't summarize it easily in a nutshell, but it would seem that for Lacan, the child has to take distance from the maternal other for its own reasons, to kind of establish its own subjectivity, to get some distance from whatever it is in the mother that is anxiety producing. Because Lacan wants us to say, yeah, it's not just a lovey-dovey comfort zone. There's something that has to be avoided. By the way, the very word avoided kind of conveniently raises all this stuff. To avoid is, in a sense, to negate a void.
Yeah.
To make something that is a void safely distant or controlled in some way. So these themes really come back and start more and more. And I do a lot of excavating in the first couple chapters of Embracing the Void. There we have it, Embracing the Void.
Right.
Not avoiding the void, but kind of really trying to analyze it is the point.
So the name of the father kind of comes in. My understanding of the name of the father would be it has a lot to do with the symbolic ideas of.
Yes, it's absolutely. It's like another word for his symbolic His symbolic order is the name of the Father, exactly. Our relationship to language and how does our relationship to language stabilize us to some crucial extent, giving us some refuge from exposure to anxiety? Yeah.
So would that almost be like what would explain, like, that the first word typically that an infant says is no?
Yes, absolutely. That's a very, that's a great point. No. Exactly.
Yeah.
There is a certain point. It's not the first thing that the infant says, but there is, as it begins to feel a bit more mastery of language, it interestingly goes into the period of the no saying, of quite obviously taking a certain amount of enjoyment in denying, saying no. No, I won't.
Yeah.
Make me, you know. It's a provocation, and it's really unmistakably a kind of declaration of independence.
Yeah. I wonder if we could, maybe this is, yeah, I think maybe we could. So Lacan is rooting anxiety first in the enigmatic, unknown desire of the mother, of the primary caregiver relationship. And that is different than, say, where Heidegger or Sartre or maybe even Kierkegaard would have located anxiety. But I'm not as familiar with them, but I have a friend who's like interested in Sartre, so they're reading Nausea, and so I would love to kind of spell out what is sort of the difference conceptually.
Great. It's interesting because Lacan and Sartre and Heidegger, Heidegger in particular, likes to rehearse the ways, remind us of the ways in which he's not a Sartrean. But it's interesting that they both share more than a little of their conception of anxiety, because anxiety in both Sartre and in Heidegger is the anxiety, as Sartre put it, the dizziness of Dasein, the dizziness of the for itself, as Sartre puts it, in the full exposure to its own vertiginous freedom, that I'm capable of doing anything. And the famous example is Sartre says, well, when I'm standing on the precipice of the cliff and I'm experiencing this horrible kind of near nausea of terror that we call vertigo,
yeah,
it's not the fear that I'm going to fall. It's the fear that I'm going to jump. It's the fear that I'm free. At any moment, there's nothing separating me from killing myself right now. All it will take is one step, and it's over.
Yeah.
And the for itself, the conscious being that Sartre gives us as the centerpiece of his existential understanding, this pure for itself is terrified, in a certain sense, of its own arbitrary freedom. That it's nothing is constraining it. Nothing's out of bounds. I can step off the cliff at any moment. And Heidegger actually is not quite the same, but his conception of anxiety also is anxiety that Dasein has in relationship to its own open question. Toward the latter part of Heidegger's writing and his teaching, he says Dasein is held out into the nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We are, and this is, it's very Sartrean, actually, from a certain point of view.
Yeah.
And Lacan wants to say, no, the seat of anxiety is not a self-confrontation, a kind of turning inward and finding myself to be terrifying. Yes, it is that at some point. Okay. But it's originally my encounter with the fellow human being, where they are the abyss, where they are the cliff, where they are the sort of dizzying and nauseating, terrifying unknown. So here, emphatically, anxiety starts with the confrontation of something other than and outside oneself. It's not one's own powers. It's what I fear and don't understand about the other. In the case of the mother, the one I am most intimate with, the mother, the one I'm most of all others, the most comfortable. But even that one is at a certain point utterly terrifying. That's his radical stake.
And is that a way of understanding his word for extimacy?
Yes, exactly. Extimacy, actually, the word has become, I guess it's such a lovely, it's such a lovely play on the intime, extime. If we have intimacy, we can also have extimacy. Yes, it's exactly what extimacy originally meant. It actually only occurs in that discussion in the seminar only one time. He only used it one time, but it's become a kind of a, I don't know, it's such a irresistible.
So
I just contributed to a whole book. It is, I don't think it's out yet, called The Extimate. Essays on Lacan's notion of the extimate.
It would be that what is most intimate to me is first outside me.
Absolutely. Here's the way that works, or at least one of the ways it works. It's a very subtle, and I think actually quite, it's just hard to overstate how important this is in Lacan's whole view. It's not that it's not at all that it's not relevant to my own unanswered question. Who the hell am I? And what, by the way, do I want? And is it possible that I terrify myself? Of course. But for Lacan, I come to myself through the other. I only really come to realize how much of an unanswered question I am when I begin to get some kind of sense that the other, even the one who I thought I knew the most, this mothering figure, I don't know at some level, I don't know at all. It sort of like bounces, as it were, back on me that I don't know about her. And that means I don't know about anything, certainly not about what I want. Which then means, just to patch this back to what we were talking about, the name of the Father a minute ago.
Yeah.
One could say then that really the first function of language, which is of course a support outside with anybody else, insofar as we are speaking to each other, we're using these tokens where we mutually understand the meanings, and all of a sudden, okay, I get it. We're sort of like hung in suspension over the tiger trap, you know, the depths of the cliff. But as long as we're up here talking, we kind of are buoyed up. One could say, I think this is the nom du père, the name of the Father, in its reassuring function, in its saving function, in its being a kind of resource against anxiety. As long as we're talking, you know, it's kind of like, this is what makes a kid go to bed at night, and that when it's terrified, and dad or mom reads a story. It's incredibly reassuring. And Lacan would say what's reassuring ultimately is the language itself, because we agree on what home means and what fire means and what, you know, cookies mean and what milk means. We're resting now on a kind of illusion anyway of a terra firma, instead of this abyssal, anxiety producing emptiness.
Okay. And now I'm thinking of, you know, you've talked in some parts about just all the social niceties too that we engage in, the hey, how are you, all of that that kind of thing that just,
Right.
I wonder though, maybe if we could, talk a little bit about, Mari Rudy. And, in my first email with you, I brought up this part on page 47 of The Call of Character, and she talks about socialization, which I take it to mean that socialization would be her in this case. It is the name of the father, Le Nom du Père, and that kind of thing. Okay. It divests us of our infantile fantasy of wholeness and uncomplicated belonging, generating an unquenchable longing for a state of plenitude that we imagine we have somehow been unfairly robbed of, a lost paradise we can never recover, but that we spend the rest of our lives pursuing. Lacan designates this lost paradise as the thing, indicating by the capital T that it is not an ordinary fantasy object, but a very special thing of incomparable worth. It is the thing that our deepest desires are made of. And then I kind of went on to ask you, that it seems to me that on one hand, you're saying, yes, on one hand, socialization separates us from the primary caregiver. And perhaps that does install within us a sense of having fallen away from paradise. But on the other hand, socialization is what saves us from the overwhelming anxiety of the saturation of the mother's presence. It saves us from Dasding, or from confronting Dasding. So maybe I'll skip down to just like the symbolic is kind of like a lifeline. And that seems to unlock a lot regarding our understanding our obsessions with symbolic rituals, customs, rules, imaginary identities. Each of these act as a kind of, as various crutches or shields to allay our anxiety of dusting. But is there, you know, her line that we spend the rest of our lives pursuing a paradise we fantasize that we've lost. And this strikes me as somehow different from what you're arguing, that it's almost more like we'll spend the rest of our lives pursuing one after another symbolic identity, or imaginary identities or distractions in order to repress our anxiety about paradise.
Okay, great. Let me go for a minute and then I'll check back in.
Yeah.
But Mari does take a different take on this. And I actually think her take is fully valid. So I like what she says when she talks about in the book, what does she call it? The stakes of falling in love or something. I've forgotten the exact title.
The case for falling in love. Yeah.
She uses it there too. She uses it repeatedly in a lot of her work where the thing is really what you're looking for. It's the kind of touchstone of something really genuine that's going to be the real payback for going through a lot of other stuff that's kind of tough. It's that in the other that you've kind of like always been looking for and not daring to believe that you're ever going to get it and so on. I don't disagree with that. I don't even disagree with her using this term borrowed from the problematic that goes all the way back to Freud, das Ding, the thing. She usually leaves it in the English.
Yeah.
But so how can this be? Aren't we kind of like completely arguing completely different things? No, for the following reason. When we first are ushered into language, this I take it is kind of boilerplate Lacan. Though Lacan, as we know, is so unsystematic in his presentation of his ideas that it's easy to miss this. And yet it's the heart of the thing. We're initially drawn into language, into the paternal metaphor, yes, in a kind of Oedipal way. We're drawn off from the abyssal character of the mother insofar as she can be that way. She can be a kind of unknown there's the thing in the mother, the crocodile mother, the praying mantis mother. The father is in the first place a kind of stabilization. Language is a welcome way of, yes, getting socialization, feeling like, okay, we're in a kind of social world. But once I am a speaking being in a linguistic community, the other even more important function of language starts to kick in, which is the capacity to always say more than I meant to say. Language, yes, as you were saying, we have the language, the kind of banal, empty speech, if to go back to one of Lacan's early formulas, our empty speech of the hi, how are you? Fine, how are you? This is just blah, 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 which says to the other person, this is just a routine meeting. It doesn't mean anything. So let's just kind of get on with whatever we have to do today, because I'm just acknowledging your presence. Hi, how are you? Good, how are you? Bye-bye. This is how we get by each other. It's almost language functioning as the grease that allows the cogs of the wheels to not generate friction. However, it's also possible that the same language with the same person, another moment down the line of your interaction, might have a completely different valence and product. Like, what if I said to somebody, hey, how are you? You know, how you doing? And the other person says, oh, I know you're just kind of saying that because that's what one says, but actually, I got to tell you, I'm really not good. And hearing you say that right now makes me feel panicked. I'm like kind of freaking out. All of a sudden, notice what's happened. In the middle of the discourse that's supposed to be the everyday routine script to minimize anxiety has suddenly been slightly kind of skewed, and you're in a real existential kind of moment with somebody, and you're having to tell yourself or ask yourself, well, what the hell am I going to say now? Do I even have time to get involved with this person and whatever's going on with them? And I don't know, maybe. But Lacan is fascinated, I think, with this dual function of language. It both stabilizes us, but it also always has the potential to say something to us that we didn't expect, and then ask something of us, to encounter something that we have never really encountered. So language, it's as if language is both covering over and helping me contain the unconscious, but then in another moment, it's actually opening the door to something I haven't ever considered. So I'm thinking of the poem that you just read about the garden and the song lyrics. You know, I found myself thinking it while you were reading it. I thought, the garden is, I'm hearing it in my ear as a kind of the opposite of the Garden of Eden. I don't know if I'm interpreting it right, but I was finding it dark and kind of, mysterious. Attractive in a way, but also kind of scary in a way. Like, wow, is this good or bad, the garden? Where is this place and what happens there and so on? I would have had to read the thing or heard you talk about it again to know a little better what's really going on there. But Lacan would say, I think this is why he thinks language is, this was what originally motivated his idea, which he then backpedals on a bit. Of what he called empty speech and what he called full speech. I think he hated the word full and realized he made a terrible mistake because language never speaks fully. But the point was, there is a kind of superficial socializing use of language that flattens everything and makes us all kind of forget our anxieties. But in the next moment, language can say something that is unnerving and maybe still welcoming, precisely in being out of the box and out of the playbook. And Lacan loves to say this to us, you know, in speaking, we always say more than we meant to. Or in language, something occurs that is always more than was intended. And that's this kind of opening. So I think, anyway, Mari and I have great respect for Mari. She was a dear friend of mine. And I was very sorry about her death this year. But I don't think that she does handle dusting differently. She does tend to point it in the direction of the thing that you yourself most deeply need and want, even though it's challenging. And you find it sometimes, if you're lucky, in some other person, and then in yourself. Where I tend to put, I put most of the emphasis in what I've written on dusting into the more anxiety encounter part of it.
Yeah.
But they're both, I think they're both there. It's like different.
I kind of just a slightly different emphasis. I mean, for me, something about psychoanalytic theory, probably most particularly Mari's work, had some, well, she likes to use the term an echo of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your guys' work itself for me has been this, you use the word ineluctably in your book several times. I'm ineluctably, irresistibly drawn to your work and Mari's work and Peter Rollins and Jameson Webster, and yet terrified by it too, I have to admit, at the same time.
By the way, when Mari is saying about falling in love, that you're falling in love with something that you've kind of always been waiting for, it's the inner thing that's really, really like the treasure. This is not necessarily a comfortable situation.
Yeah.
It can be quite terrifying, precisely to be in this anxious moment of, it's right there. You embody it, can be terrifying.
Yeah. Well, and you, I was thinking maybe we'd get into this later, but maybe now's a good time to bring it up. I mean, one of the things that I love the most about psychoanalysis is this idea of the ethics of psychoanalysis, that this idea of the, you know, how he talks about that the only, that Lacan talks about that the only thing we can be guilty of is giving ground on our desire. And it's a difficult, I've tried to write some essays and explain to some friends how that is, it's not as simple as just like hedonism. It's, I do have a quote from you that kind of succinctly distills that, but I'm wondering if I just were to pitch it over to you, why is that not hedonism?
Well, hedonism, as we usually understand it, is, we can go right back to the Freudian point of departure here, the phrase beyond the pleasure principle. Usually hedonism means a kind of almost drugged state that is given to me, over to me, or I'm given over to it through waves of pleasure. You know, good food, good music, good art, good sex, good, you know, a kind of orgy of the beautiful. And so hedonism really is on the side of pleasure, where the real crux of the issue, and this is true for Freud in his own, you know, idiosyncratic way, but also very true of Lacan, is the beyond of the pleasure principle. It's the death drive that becomes really the one of the signals, one of the kind of evocations of, always dangerous to use the word authentic with Lacan, but that's the Heideggerian word for it, this encounter with something that really means something.
Yeah.
And it's challenging far from being just pleasurable. And this is, of course, a huge amount of what he means by jouissance, and what he means by the real. It's something that the imaginary is mostly configured to spare me exposure to the real. Language is interestingly two-faced about this. Language, yes, it usually functions to stabilize us, to give us that, as you were saying, that kind of social stability, that we know who we are, we know who the others are. But then language can also, famously in the poem, but of course not only in poetry, language has this power, as Lacan would say, to say more than you intended. It has this power of calling up something beyond anything that one would ordinarily take from what was said. It's the unsaid sometimes. So language is in this way, for Lacan, this kind of, this was from the start, you know, it's a kind of a calming, regulating system.
Yeah.
But it's also the key to going into that, you know, what Hitchcock and people who conjured the house with the unknown room in the back that houses something that is unimaginable and is going to really shake you up, you know. Language is the key to that bedroom.
The uncanny.
Yes, the uncanny, of course, is the exactly.
I love you were explaining in a talk how the uncanny, it's Unheimlich in German, right?
Unheimlich, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
Heim, where Heim is German for the home, the homestead. Yeah. You know, the Unheimlich is the horrifyingly foreign and threatening and so on. By the way, the I don't know how far you want to go down the road of the embracing book, but this is exactly the direction I want to take in that book by associating the religious with, or something like the sacred, with an intimate relation to Das Ding, that there is something, there is a way in which the religious, the sort of feeling for the sacred is inevitably an entering into the, what is most deeply anxiety producing, the dark night of the soul, as St. John of the Cross put it. However, there also can be, and here we meet Mari again, only by going into the depths of that terrifying dark night of the soul does one have the possibility of encountering something ultimate, and thereby something that you just can't say no to, something that transforms you, even as you don't understand maybe even the most of it, what exactly you're encountering.
And, okay, I know we don't have, we're probably coming up on running out of time.
The tolerance of your listeners is running out.
I don't know, like, maybe we can try to, you know, we basically, it's kind of like what we've been talking about is about what would be the first part of this book of Embracing the Void, of kind of laying out these Lacanian concepts so that then we can understand how that helps us to rethink the sacred. And so you go into Greek polytheism, Judaism, and Christianity. In some sense, so you're maybe just briefly, the way I understand it would be that you're saying that the mysterious unknown in Greek polytheism is pushed a long way off you know, onto Mount Olympus. We experience the forces of nature. We have earthquakes and wind and fires and famines and this kind of droughts, and attribute it to some gods whose desire is enigmatic to us. And so we in some sense, I guess, become obsessed with rituals. Is that kind of a way of understanding how dusting interacts with Greek polytheism?
Yeah, to some extent, although I would take another route into the problematic. I would start with Freud. Freud, I just saw this recently made film for Netflix, Freud's Last Session, where Anthony Hopkins plays Freud in the last year of his life, and he's visited by C.S. Lewis. So there,
I saw that too.
Did you see it?
Mm-hmm.
And Freud, Hopkins does a very valiant, and I think pretty convincing version of Freud, but he's doing his usual thing with religion, and he's relentlessly critiquing C.S. Lewis for his naivete, his childlike hope for you know, all big bad bullies and boogeymen to go away and leave you protected and happy and so on and so on, loved and so on. And Freud says, it's too obvious. It's a wish fulfillment. I mean, come on, you know, this is Freud's basic thing. It's an infantile wish fulfillment. It's an immaturity of a reasonable being that we have to simply graduate from. End of story. Well, that is pretty much Freud's critique. It's a question of religion as a kind of protective swaddling blanket for grown-ups. You know, it's kind of like a nice nursery to which grown-ups can return and feel better. And it seems to me that the other question, and a lot of there's another tradition that Freud doesn't pay much attention to, which is the religion of challenge. I think of there are a number of great religious writers who want to pose this challenge of the divine. By the way, my book is, if anything, much more atheistic than it is religious. Although I would say it's a little bit unusual because it's. I think if you read it carefully, it isn't just atheistic. It simply says, at the core of our impulse, what we call our kind of relation to the sacred or some kind of religious sensibility, sensate, that is our relationship to what is unknown. What's different in the way I treat it, and what is Lacanian in the way I treat it, is it's not just apophatic theology, the famous negative theology that's been practiced and elaborated for centuries and centuries in the West, the Christian tradition anyway, the idea that God is unknowable. That's not new. And I'm not proposing to discover something that people have been talking about for centuries. What I'm trying to say is that Lacan really gives us, through resuscitating Freud on this, he gives us a new whole angle of view by saying the original site of this unknown is in my fellow human being.
Yeah.
Therefore, this is really brief and I don't want to drag out too long for your listeners who are suffering. The real idea here can be put, I think, most succinctly by saying, my book is very sympathetic with religion in some ways. Christianity is the great, it's the religion that comes the closest to this idea, this theory, I guess you'd say, that the deepest, most deeply moving experience we have is this experience of the unknown in the other. And that is, I want to argue, in various religions, that relation to dusting is the real heartbeat of the religious, of the sense of the sacred. And I trace it in different religions. However, almost all religions, in one way or another, drop the ball. They betray their own kind of openness to this kind of existential adventure of encountering the unknown. And Christianity, I argue, is the worst offender. It both comes the closest when Christ says to his followers, the point is just to be open to one another, to love one another. I am there wherever two or more of you are gathered in love. It's your neighbor. It's how you open yourself, take the courage to open yourself to the neighbor, to the other person, maybe who don't even know this person yet. The neighbor is not literally your next door neighbor. It's their fellow human being. This is what is extraordinary. It's it's asking you to embrace das Ding.
Yeah.
However, Christianity then chokes itself with all of this dogma, all this kind of elaborated belief, as if to sort of say, don't worry, this is not going to get too anxiety producing, not going to get too weird. We have all these rules that will save us from confusions. And then Christianity goes out to root out other unacceptable forms of religion, or lacks of it altogether, and has been a massive, murderous movement on the planet for the last 2,000 years. So Christianity is kind of like gets the prize and gets put in the discipline pen under my interpretation.
Yeah, I think that that's, again, you're kind of, it's like these awkward situations that I talked about before, where something just doesn't quite sit right with me when, okay, I've just met someone and I'm all of a sudden kind of being asked, you know, how my relationship with Jesus is, or whether I believe at all. And I think as I'm wrestling with this, I'll be able to in the future just kind of maybe understand what's going on better in that, and respond maybe in a more in a gracious way, or in a way that doesn't upset me in some way. But that it's like, wait a minute, we're kind of, by being so obsessed with the dogmas, with the creeds, it is this way of drawing a circle around who's safe and who's not safe.
As I read it, the spirit of this is Jesus, were he to come back, he would say, fellas, people, you're all turning to me as if your love for me is what I'm asking of you. And he would say, no, forget me. I'm not the issue. Loving me is not the issue. Loving the next person you meet is the issue. Forget about me. I'm just the one who told you that the really religious gesture is the gesture of a loving understanding, an acceptance, an openness to the next person you meet.
Yeah.
Even if they're somebody lying half conscious 10 paces down the entrance to the restaurant that you're walking into with your buddies. That's the person you have to worry about, not me. I'm fine, thank you. And I tried to teach this, and then what did you do? You turned me into another Yahweh. You turned me into another Zeus. You turned me into another God among God, above all gods. When my message was, no, I am there wherever two of you are or more of you are gathered. That's what I'm about.
Well, and for me, that is that is like, you know, really like an inspiring yet terrifying challenge that I hope that my life can be about that. I do, you know, I do have, I guess maybe I feel like I have to ask you that something to this effect of, I wrote down, okay, let me put on my N.T. Wright cap. Are you familiar with N.T. Wright at all?
It doesn't ring something immediately, but go ahead. Who is N.T. Wright?
Well, he's I think he's an Anglican bishop in the line of like C.S. Lewis, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And has written on, you know, kind of the historicity of the resurrection and that sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions is like, would the injunction to love the enemy have survived if it weren't for the early church's obsession with belief, creeds, dogmas? You know, 2,000 years ago, something mysterious happened such that today we have the teachings and biography of Jesus. Do you ever speculate about what historically really happened? Or is that speculating sort of set aside? Like, I, maybe to jump down to it, like, does it almost give too much ground toward getting focused on the wrong thing to start?
Well, I should make a cautious answer, but I probably won't.
Okay.
I guess what I would say, and I was aware of making this choice in the book and worrying a bit about it being a kind of an overwrought resolution of or answer to the question you just posed. Where did Christianity go off its own road? I lay a lot of it at Paul's door. The Pauline idea, Paul was the first to really give us the story of this wandering rabbi's life. And it was Paul who really makes it, to put it crudely, a kind of concern for one's own afterlife, as if the stakes are do the right thing and make it into the Club Med of the skies, or do the wrong thing and or suffer the punishment. I think that, yes, there are passages where Jesus is in the Gospels appears to talk about this, but I basically take the position, which is to some extent arbitrary, that the real inner spirit of Jesus' teaching is not about the reward in the next world for you for having been a real swell guy. No, it's the reward that you will reap from going out and taking the risk to embrace your fellow human being, where that can be scary. Back to dusting, where you really open your arms to something you don't know and therefore don't have any real reason to be reassured and trustful. You're taking a risk. I think that's what, at least that's the real message that I kind of take from the Jesus figure. It's a message that I obviously arrive at by applying this kind of challenge of the Lacanian idea of dusting as we live it out psychologically. To that extent, it is. It's my kind of construction. Whether or not it does justice to the to founding a kind of a new way of looking at Christianity remains a totally different question, I guess.
Well, yeah, and again, to just reiterate, I mean, it is this exciting, terrifying challenge that I hope I can live into. I feel like it's like I just want to say like thank you for, in some sense, I am like the person that you've met on the side of the road who just emailed you with these long questions and things, and that you've generously opened yourself up to me. I, you know, thinking about some of this, I mean, and kind of wrapping up here because I know you probably need to go. I've been reading Bruce Fink, his book Lacan on Love, and he says, in the course of every analyst's training, a change has occurred in the economy of their desire, such that he can love and hate as passionately or violently as anyone else, but he is imbued with a stronger desire, a desire to get at the unconscious and to follow it wherever it may lead. And yeah, that just reading that, I was like, that's just so seems like this so right in line with, you know, what I take you to be talking about with the openness to the otherness of the other, and even to the otherness in oneself. And
But there's a certain brief point where I take advantage of this and say, actually, it's not that far a stretch to say that one of the most wonderful reincarnations of Jesus appeal to us to love one another, even those of whom we are somewhat afraid. One of the greatest modern instantiations of that is precisely the great Jewish science of psychoanalysis, where one really does have to take the analyst on and open with, in a sentence, a certain sense, open arms, non-judgmentally, really just asking, in a sense, tell me who and what you are. And I will hear that openly, a kind of open arms. That is a lovely little paradox to finish the book with.
That's beautiful. I mean, I do wish that we could have maybe gone more into, you know, talking through some of the ways in which this works, these ideas can help us to make sense of like Greek polytheism and Judaism. But if anybody who's listening, you know, grab the book, look up, just type in Richard Boothby into YouTube. You'll find different interviews. And lectures that he's given, and yeah, I'm really appreciative of. I feel like your work has it's like it came in and just really, in a satisfying way, answered some of these questions that I've been wrestling with. So, thank you. And is there anything else that you'd like to say before we sign off?
No, just to thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for looking at my writing and taking it seriously and wanting to share it with other people. I'm grateful and have enjoyed it. So thanks.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Rick. And I'm gonna hit stop recording here.
This is my garden. This is my home. I seem to have all I want, but in this garden, you give me all but for one. That's my only thought. it will satisfy. Delights my eye and makes me wise, desired by all and had by none. This is my garden. Am I the only one? 'Cause I am naked to my all I want. If you really love, I'd be rich with that.